If those few notes send a chill down your spine, I don't have to say another word. You know the story. You feel the danger, whether you practically live on the water or never get closer than a postcard or a movie theater. The sharks are on the move, and tonight we're telling you where, before you find out on your own. Shark attacks are rare, but this hour, you're going to meet three people who can testify that the danger is real. It happened to them, and they will never be the same. Plus, it was a movie that terrorized swimmers for decades. Even the cast of Jaws was scared to go back in the water. Jeffrey Kramer, who played Deputy Jeff Hendricks, joins me live tonight to talk about the lasting effect of the classic hit. And then, the word police strike again. Find out what happened when a man sued his company after someone called him bald. And what were they thinking when they said, till death do them part? Talk about burning love. We're going to explain the headline behind this picture. All ahead tonight on Banfield. Hello and welcome to a Friday the 13th edition of Banfield. The good news is it's almost Saturday the 14th and it is almost vacation season. Sun and surf, depending on where you're sunning and surfing, and sharks. I'm going to leave it to you as to whether that's good news or bad news, but knowledge is power. And tonight we know the whereabouts of some of the biggest sharks in the open ocean, often just within a few feet. This guy, for instance. He is called Ironbound, named for the island off of Nova Scotia in Canada, where he was first spotted and then tagged back in 2019. He is very much alive, and he is 12 feet long and a great white shark. He weighs just under 1,000 pounds. And yes, those teeth are real. His tag pings. It pings on a satellite every time he gets near the surface. And the latest ping was on Tuesday, right where you see that little shark icon off the North Carolina coast. The blue dots are previous pings, and the lines around the lines represent Ironbound's travels up and down the eastern seaboard. His trackers estimate that he has covered 13,000 miles in the 2.5 years since they've had a close eye on him. And he, of course, is not the only shark in the ocean, and not the only one being monitored by the conservation group called OSearch. You can go to osearch.org, and you too can follow the comings and goings of more than 400 of these beasts that you really don't want to run into on your own. Chris Fisher is OSearch's founder and expedition leader, and he joins me now from Louisville, Kentucky, which is, by my count, a long way away from the ocean. Chris, have you found any sharks near you, or do you just live where you live and travel to where you work?
I happen to be visiting my parents. I grew up here in Louisville, so I'm in town for the weekend.
Okay, so let's get right to business. You say facts over fear, because for a lot of people, shark, even the name, Shark Week, it just it conjures up terror that there are monsters lurking in the ocean. And for people like you, nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah, I think that is really the biggest misconception in the ocean space. The fact of the matter is, as these large sharks go, we go. They're actually the guardians of our fish stocks. And so if our shark numbers aren't thriving, the ocean's not thriving, and that means there's not fish for the future. And that's really why we do our work, because the path to abundance goes through the white shark.
And so talk to me about Ironbound. We showed the pictures off the top. He just looks so scary with the teeth and the size and the just imagining him beneath the surface. I mean, you know, I'm a layman, you're not, and you've swum up close and personal with them. But he's not a monster, really. Size-wise, he's really not even that big, is he?
No, he's a, you know, would be like a young, mature male, you know, really in the prime of his life, but not really at his maximum kind of white shark that he will become. So he's gonna probably getting beat up pretty good by the larger male white sharks, and particularly around mating season and around seal haul outs where they're competing for food. And, you know, we caught him at West Ironbound, as you mentioned, and we'd been working there for a number of years. That's where we found white sharks in Nova Scotia for the first time. And that's a really special place that is a vicious kind of weather, fierce place. And we wanted the right shark to carry its name. And this shark certainly was that. He wasn't big, but he was determined.
Okay, what does that mean when you say not big but determined? What does determined in your work mean?
Well, you know, it's we handle a lot of white sharks. You know, we handle 17-foot massive females that are almost 4,000 pounds. But over the years of all the sharks we've handled, kind of the toughest, trickiest ones seem to be these kind of smaller, mature males in the 12 and a half feet range. You know, they're not as big as the other sharks, so they're a little more agile. And you could see that Ironbound had been chewed up by other large sharks, had been kind of harassing him and whatever. And he just had that determination, that 12-foot, you know, just mature male. It's kind of like a 22-year-old male human, right? You know, really in the prime of its life and strength, but still trying to come up. And he was a tough shark to handle.
I just want to tell you the pictures that we're seeing beside your face are so fantastic. Are these pictures that you took or members of your team? They're just remarkable.
Yeah, that's our team that's following the work while we're out working on the ship. You know, we open source everything in real time so the world can follow it on OSearch social handles and students can follow it. So all that stuff is coming right off the ship while we're doing the work.
Awesome. Okay, I want to play something that happened in Australia just from last month. You don't have to be bitten by a shark to be just a wee bit scared of them. But this instance, it was a family that was fishing with their teenage son. And I, you know, as is normal, I think they were hauling in the catch and they had the camera rolling. And this honestly could look like a recreation from the movie Jaws. So let's play it. I want to ask you about it on the other side. Okay, so I never expected that a shark would come after you if you were above the water. But this was a very aggressive shark. It was a great white that circled this boat for an hour. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's just something to be celebrated. You got to understand, in some parts of the world, we're returning the world's oceans into our great wild oceans. It's not doom and gloom everywhere. And when you're out on the water and you're in a really wild ocean, it's a sharky place. Like when you go to the Galapagos or the Great Barrier Reef, these really pristine places are super sharky, and that means the waters are abundant. So I think we're all going to have to learn how to adjust in some parts of the world, and particularly in the United States on both coasts, that our oceans are returning to some of the great wild oceans again. You know, it's not going to be like it was in the 80s and the 90s when really our oceans were mostly empty because we'd overharvest them. We've done an amazing job bringing them back. And with that, you know, comes more large sharks, but that means there's also more cod and more stripers and more snook and more mahi. And so it's really something, the return to abundance in the wild ocean off the East Coast because of the work over the last 30 years is something to be really celebrated. But what does that mean for us humans? Well, we need to learn how to adapt now. Now, to really having a pristine ocean off of our beaches again and not one that was empty. So that means more fish, more sharks, a brighter future for our grandchildren. And it's really something that should be celebrated. I mean, you know, you're seeing whales in front of the Statue of Liberty again.
Yeah, I love your positivity because it's true. This is a good thing. But then I see a video of this guy in Australia who was on a paddleboard and he got between, I think it was a tiger shark and a turtle. And it's nothing short of just remarkable what happened. I'm going to show that just quickly, just so that our viewers can see what it means when you get between a shark and its prey. Take a look.
Tiger shark and this turtle, big showdown. And I'm right in the thick of it. Oh, no. Oh! Holy oh, this is intense. They're underneath me. Look, the tiger's got the turtle underneath me. Oh, I don't know if I'm in the best position right here. Oh, I'm between the tiger and the turtle. Uh-oh. Oh! What?
Ooh. Okay, Chris, I think the one question everybody has when they see that is, if you fall in the water and there is a tiger shark, should you be going for the GoPro or should you be doing something completely different?
Well, you know, you should never fall in the water. I mean, right, that was just really poor judgment. You should be paddling out of that area. All that turtle was doing was trying to hide up against his little kayak all the time, and so that brings the shark in. So rather than sitting there and staring at it, probably be best just to walk on, just like if you were walking through your forest and you saw a mountain lion stalking a deer, I doubt you'd try to walk into the middle of that and hang out. So that was a poor judgment call that lended to a bad situation.
I think that's the smartest thing to say. If you saw a mountain lion, would you really just get in between it and its prey and keep the video going? But man, was that ever something to see. Chris Fisher, thanks so much for the work you do, and thanks for being on tonight. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And be careful out there as well. If my next guests have a fear of sharks or oceans or even bathtubs, for that matter, it is completely founded. We have one woman that we heard about who was snorkeling with her husband in the Bahamas when she felt something bump against her arm. Her name is Tiffany Johnson. Something didn't bump against her arm. Something actually took her arm. That was back in 2017. Kent Bondi was spearfishing also in the Bahamas when a bull shark took out part of his leg. And he's now a member of the advocacy group Shark Survivors for Sharks. And Keen Hayes was diving for lobster back in 2018 when at 13 years old, he thought his buddy was pranking him under the water, and it was not his buddy. 1,000 stitches later, Keen was clamoring to get back in the ocean, which is really remarkable. Welcome to all three of you. Tiffany, I want to begin with you, if I can. You were snorkeling by yourself. Your husband didn't feel well, didn't want to be snorkeling that day. And then something happened. So take me through, in a nutshell, what happened when you realized you were in trouble?
Well, honestly, I was just snorkeling, you know, just watching the fish interact, you know, looking at God's creation under the water. And I felt like I had bumped into something. And that's literally the thought that went through my mind. So I was very casual, turned to my right to see what I had bumped into. And I was face to face with a shark, and he had my whole arm pinned in his mouth.
And that's hard for us to understand. Your arm is in his mouth, but all your consciousness is saying is, I've bumped into something. When did it become very real? And when did you actually have to wrench your arm out of his mouth?
I didn't understand what had happened until I had turned and I was face to face with him. And so at that point, you know, of course, fear took over. I started having visions of my kids, you know, playing in the yard with my husband, and just like a movie reel of my life, you know, started to play. And I had to push those thoughts back. And I remember thinking, no, you will not take my life. I'm not going to die here. And I just had to yank, and I kept yanking. And of course, that's when there was a lot of commotion, you know, me screaming through my snorkel tube and a lot of splashing and yanking and fighting. And at some point during the struggle, his jaws opened, but my arm just kind of flew out and it was gone. It was just a severed stump at that point.
Wow. And still you were able to get back to the boat. You've got a robotic arm now. I don't know if you can lift it into the zoom shot, but wow, that's actually pretty cool. Your kids must think that's pretty cool, but you must look at it and remember that every day.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely changed life for me, but goodness, God is so good. And I'm able to, you know, be able to help others in their struggles, and watching others go through things, I can help them choose joy, choose peace, choose the things that the Lord has for us. And that's been a blessing to see it be used in that way. Because if it had to happen, at least in the second chance, I'm able to help others in it.
Well, in that vein, I'm going to say the name of your website, because you're Be an Overcomer. That's your motto. And that's your website, beanovercomerministries.com. You can connect with Tiffany and get these, you know, super positive messages. Kent, let me turn to you for a minute. You don't like the term attack. You would prefer that people use the term accident when we discuss shark encounters.
Absolutely. The reason I refer to it more so as an accident as an attack is it's we are really not the intended target in most cases. You know, we're doing something that's attracting the animals to begin with. We're either spear fishing, we're fishing, or we're swimming in an area that either their natural prey happens to be in, and we just happen to be there in their environment at the time. So, you know, in my particular case, I was spear fishing, and I, you know, I broke protocol, got too far away from the boat. I was coming up with a fish on my spear, and a shark came in on the scent of the fish that I was that I had shot, and was after the fish, and not so much my leg. And with the time I got hit, he got my leg, and you know, completely skipped my leg and came up with a fish that I shot. So it was that quick, and never came back for a second bite, or never even came back. Never gave me a second shot. So. In my mind, and from other people I've talked to that have had similar situations to mine, you know, we are, you know, so not part of the equation. It was more so we're doing something to attract them. So clearly an accident, and not so much a premeditated event.
Sure. And often I hear that we are not the preferred flavor for sharks. They do a sample bite and oftentimes don't want more than that. So lucky for all three of you, you're here. But Kent, this was a 7.5-foot bull shark, and you were 100 yards from your boat. How on earth did you make it back?
We all, as dive instructors and boat captains, we all had medical training. So, you know, you just never anticipate having to use that training on yourselves. We were east end of Grand Bahama Island, about 3.5 miles from shore, and had none of the protocols on board that one would normally think you would have in terms of having a VHF radio or a cell phone or anything like that. And it was just, you know, really all the training that we had that pretty much resulted in my ability to get back safely. So it was just not my time, and clearly our, you know, what we had in place was what resulted in my, we'd be talking to you right now. So
it's amazing that you can sort of laugh through this. And I think as you're making that 100-yard swim, bleeding out, are you also terrified of the amount of blood in the water and that you're in the middle of it?
You know, the first thing I did when I hit the surface was, you know, I looked at my leg. It was about as graphic of a wound as you can imagine. It tore out 80% of my calf. It was literally an ice cream scoop removal of my leg, of my calf rather. I could see bone, I could see everything, and it missed the lower branch of my femoral artery by 3/16 of an inch. I hit surface. The first thing I thought was, okay, don't hit me again. I looked at the boat. I realized I was over 100 yards away from the boat, and I didn't want to. What went through my mind was I didn't want to die without my wife not knowing where I was. So I just started swimming for the boat, and I got to probably within 100 feet or so of the boat. And at that point I was getting real hypoglycemic. I was because I was just losing a lot of blood, and I started calling out to my wife, who was in the water towing the vessel, the boat that we had a little skiff that we were towing around. And I said, listen, Deb, I've been hit. And she said, if you've been hit, you know, hold your fish out. You know, I'm going to shave you. You know, hold your fish out of the water. I said, I don't have a fish on my spear. I've been hit by a shark, come get me. And so she let go of the boat, swam out to me. And, you know, she got to within a few yards of me and saw the extent of the injury. And her first thought was, where are the other sharks? And when in fact,
yeah.
There was no, you know, all I can say is that the minute I got hit, my first thought was, where are the other sharks? Why are sharks not coming at me with blood in the water? And all I can say is that it was almost like the ocean had emptied out. It was like something unnatural happened, big scheme of things. A shark hit my leg. That was not the intended target, got my fish and was gone. And everything else in the water came to like a standstill. I can't describe it any better, but that at least was my perception of when I got hit.
It's remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. Keen, I want to get to you now, too. You were only 13 when your shark incident, encounter, attack, everybody has a different word for it, was so intensely severe, the lifeguard apparently could see your lungs. Tell me what happened to you.
Yeah, so the first lifeguard on scene, his name is Billy, he said he could see my lungs actually breathing through my back, and we have a picture of it, and you can see my whole spine pretty much. So the humerus was broken at the top of it. I lost a lot of the muscles in my arm, so the rotator cuff, the lat muscle, and the deltoid muscle were just completely eaten. There was pretty much no muscle fibers to even grow them back, and my scapula was broken in a couple different places. So, yeah, it got me good.
But you, when this first happened, I mean, Lord, 1,000 stitches. I can't even imagine you were conscious, but you thought that your friend was pranking you? How is that? Like, walk me through that moment that it happened.
Yeah, so pretty much I was coming up from a dive, and, you know, I was coming up from the surface, and I just felt something come at me from the side. I really didn't feel like the teeth or anything. I just felt it, you know, just the impact felt like a car. And I was, you know, I came up to the surface and I was just pretty confused. I was like, what was that? And then I look over and I see, you know, all the wetsuit and all the blood and all that. And then I realized that was not my friend. So, yeah.
Yeah, not your friend. And this, again, is this is 4 years ago. So you're still a kid, like you're 17. You had an intensity to get back in the water. I think that's something a lot of people might not understand either. Walk me through how you really wanted to return to the water and how that wasn't terrifying for you.
Yeah, so I've talked to a lot of other shark attack survivors and a lot of other trauma survivors. And usually people go one of two ways. They either, in my case, you know, they would move to Montana and play golf, or they just completely, you know, envy the ocean, live, breathe the ocean. And I think I went, you know, obviously the live and breathe the ocean. But I've always just kind of had a thing with water. You know, I've always been a little fish, a little water baby. So, you know, it just kind of felt natural to go back into the water, and it didn't really scare me. You know, my mom was honestly more scared than I was, which I completely understand, but it just felt really natural, and I knew the chances of it happening again was slim to none, hopefully.
Yeah, well, that, and that's true. The statistics certainly do, you know, measure up. One of the things I love to hear from all three of you and others as well, so many people who've had encounters with sharks, accidents, attacks, they become team shark. They become shark advocates afterwards, which is, it's amazing and delightful all at the same time. So thank you to all three of you, Tiffany Johnson, Kent Bondi, and Keen Hayes. I really appreciate you sharing your stories tonight.
Of course, thank you.
So those sharks are doing only what they're supposed to do. Eating things that swim in their ocean, right? So why are we so gripped in fear when the odds are so slim that we'll encounter a shark? It is the stuff that movies are made of. And up next, how even the cast of Jaws feared the water for years. One of its stars is live with me on the legacy that movie left us a half century later. Jeffrey Kramer played Deputy Jeff Hendricks in the movie, and he's with me from Los Angeles. Gosh, it's so good to see you. I can't believe it's been almost half a century. Have you really still not shaken the fear of the water?
Well, half a century. I tell people I was 9 when this movie was made. It's the water. None of us ever went back into the water in the same way again. It was scary. The shark itself in the movie wasn't scary because it never worked. But the idea of the deep, the unknown, the primordial ooze was terrifying. People would come up to us and they were afraid to go into their swimming pools, literally.
Me too. I was afraid to be in a swimming pool, and I was afraid to swim in a lake because I was in, you know, central Canada. So you just said something interesting. You said that the mechanical shark never worked. What did you mean by that?
Well, the reason that this whole movie worked was it was a perfect storm. Perfect creative storm. The shark didn't work. So Stephen had to rely on character. And they wrote scenes. My part got a little bigger as we went along. And because they needed filler. The shark didn't work. That's why you don't see the shark. If they had to make it now, they'd want it bigger and better and faster, and it would fly, maybe.
So let me ask you, this quote was amazing when you said of the cast, none of us ever swam nor looked at the water in the same way since. What did you guys talk about? Like, what was your conversation like on the set behind the scenes as you were going through all the, you know, the filming?
Well, you know that first scene at the beach party at night? A lot of the people on that set would go swimming at night and whatever, and then it became terrifying. The idea that the water was black and who knew what was down there and what was going on, and it touched that universal unconscious fear of the depth. I'm telling you, it was like the primordial ooze, I think, that is terrifying because we don't know what's down there.
Why do you think that Jaws struck such a nerve? You know, conservationists are so upset that people from 1975 on looked at sharks as beasts and monsters, and you know, and it did worse things for sharks than anything else this globe could have thrown at them. Why do you think it struck such a nerve? And Close Encounters of the Third Kind didn't make us terrified of, you know, aliens.
Well, that's very true. I think the deep, the unknown is so terrifying in all of our unconsciousness. You know, somebody once said to me that, you know, we spend as babies in utero in the deep, in water, in liquid, and there is a universal fear of what is not known down there. And it was the biggest first blockbuster ever. It was kind of very cool.
And you were part of it. This was your first movie role, which I did not realize. Yeah. You did such a great job in it. Did you have any other profound effects from other movies that you know, did anything match the effect that Jaws had on you in your career?
Nothing ever. I helped develop The X-Files, which really had a profound effect, but that was about unexplained phenomenon. But the deep is unexplained to us, even today. And it's pretty scary because sharks just swim and eat and make little sharks, as they say in the movie. And it's kind of terrifying because we have no defense, none.
So do you ever lament the effect that Jaws had on people, for the last half century? You know, before Jaws, they didn't consider sharks monsters and terrors and all the rest. Do you ever fear, like, do you ever worry about the legacy that the movie has on how humans view sharks?
Not at all, because I think it touched this conservation of sharks. This, many people say, we understand the food chain, we understand why we need them, and they are important in the cycle of life for all of us, particularly in the oceans. And there's, you know, Peter Benchley and Wendy Benchley, and they all became shark enthusiasts. And there is a big conservation movement on Martha's Vineyard and a lot of seaside communities. Woods Hole Oceanographic is right there where they do all the research. I think it was a positive plus.
Well, it's been like a treat to talk to you, especially I had to do this math. And Jeff, I couldn't believe, like, half a century. That's not right. I must have done the math wrong. And it is
Please.
Almost half a century. Jeff Kramer, so good
about
to see you.
I lie about age every day except to get my jabs, for sure.
You were nine when you filmed Jaws. Yeah, thanks so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jeff
Bye.
Kramer joining
Thank
us.
You.
Deputy Jeff Hendricks in the movie Jaws. Coming up, your husband or your dog? Seriously, how would you answer that question? You might be surprised at how your fellow Americans have weighed in on that choice. Plus, is it sexual harassment to call someone bald? In the new frontier of what you can and cannot say, boy, have we got a story for you. Straight ahead. When was the last time you went to a wedding and then actually posted, that was lit? Because guests at a recent wedding of Gabe Jessup and Amber Michelle got the shock of their lives when the bride and groom actually lit themselves on fire. It turns out that the newlyweds are actually professional stunt people. And if they were looking to use the wedding to boost their social media followers, holy Dinah, this clip has been seen 2.8 million times.
When stunt people marry.
Dynamite. Joining me now to weigh in on this Friday night collection of news that you may have missed this week, Ben Ferguson, podcaster and host of The Ben Ferguson Show. Also with me is Page Six reporter Francesca Vaccardi and our senior story editor on The Banfield Show, who spent many years at the helm of Page Six, Paula Froelich. Welcome all. Okay, Paula.
Good to be here.
I get it. Is this the epitome of burning love?
You know, Ashley, I am a full fan of you do your wedding however the heck you want, but this video gave me more questions than answers. You do your hair, you do your makeup, then you set yourself on fire. A, how does your hair not burn up? Then you run down, then you get fire retardant blown all over you. I mean, it's just ode to weird, isn't it?
But they were professional stunt people, so methinks that they had probably lined up another set of hair and makeup artists to fix them all up after all the
okay,
goo.
Fine, but I mean, Ashley, you go through hair and makeup, and how fast does that take you? I mean, this is a professional wedding stuff.
7 minutes, and that is not a lie. I am absolutely not kidding about that. Ben, I know your hair and makeup takes about 9 minutes, but this is, I mean, I have to say, I think this is brilliant. I love this. If this is what they do for a living, I think this is fantastic.
Hey, let me tell you, I think there's a couple of things people can learn from this. One, don't take your wedding too seriously and don't turn into Bridezilla or turn it into some just obsessive thing where you can't function for 9 months or a year while you're planning it. Have a little fun with it. Number two, always get your life insurance policies secured before you do the stunt. Yes. When you're about to get married, because otherwise it's going to be really expensive after everybody insurance world sees this video. I think it's hysterical. I think it's great. I think it shows exactly why they probably are going to have a really long and happy marriage. The fact that they can take themselves not so seriously on their wedding day. And it's what they do for a living. I think if we had more people like this getting married, we'd probably have a lower divorce rate in this country. So good job to them.
Yeah, but what are they going to do for their gender reveal party? I'm terrified.
Oh, dear heavens. That's a good point. Also, I would have loved to hear that.
Trust me, Tannerite will be involved.
I would have loved to hear the photographer say, oh, I forgot to take the lens cap off. Let's redo. Can't imagine. Okay, I want to take you guys to Charleston, South Carolina. Now, forget the high-speed chase, because instead, here the police were tailing a rather large alligator all the way through a suburban neighborhood. Watch this one. Just rolling along as Mr. Alligator makes his way gently but determined. They had to call animal control in, which is obvious. And that's where they actually tried to lasso the gator when it turned into somebody's driveway. These people are all just driving by, like this is all standard op. But they did lasso the gator in a driveway. And I actually want to stop the video right here and ask you what you think is about to happen next. Francesca, what do you think happens once they get the lasso around him?
I mean, I want to say that they muzzle him or get him safely away from people, away from the neighborhood, but I don't think that's what happened. Absolutely
no.
not. I think they had
right.
a little
well,
fun.
You're right and wrong. And actually, I think that it looked like fun, but I think it's standard op. They climbed on top of the alligator like cowboys. So let's roll that video again so you can see how they ended up. Oh, man. Oh, yeah. They got him under control. Apparently, this is how it has to be done. But honest to God, Paula, you could not pay me to do this job. Certain people are made for certain jobs, and I am not one of these.
You know, it's funny that you say that, Ashley, because I once went to a professional gator wrestling place in Florida, and the gator wrestler only had one arm. Not kidding.
No, that totally makes perfect sense, actually.
By the way, he's no longer a professional.
You would think the job would beat you down.
He's an amateur if he loses an arm, right? A professional has two arms. Former professional has one arm. Can we all agree on that?
No, because he's still right getting paid. That.
No.
And once you're getting paid, you're pro.
His heart stayed in the job. And the heart stayed in the job. After all of that, he could have quit.
Yeah. You're right about that. Apparently, this was this gator had been in an elementary school, so this had to be done. For anybody who thinks, what were you doing? Just leave the guy alone. The call came in because the gator had been wandering the elementary school. So, all right, let me move on because I really adore this next story, having been a crime reporter for so long. We always hear about karma coming back to bite you in the place where the sun don't shine. But here is a reason to actually believe it. Police say a 60-year-old man in South Carolina died after a heart attack. And before you break out the tissues for Joseph Anthony McKinnon, he may have been overexerting himself while burying his girlfriend in their backyard. This after trying to conceal her murder. All right, Francesca, jump in here. This is revenge from the grave, if you ask me.
Oh, this is karma with a capital K. He got what he deserved. She said, if you're going to murder me, I'm taking you with me, leaving no survivors behind. And so now, I mean, I don't know where they went next, but he's certainly not going to be happy when he gets there.
Apparently, the neighbors saw him unconscious, and I'm thinking, and you didn't think the neighbors were going to see you digging a grave? I mean, it's pretty astounding all around. All right, guys, stay with me. Chris Rock, as we all know, learned a lesson the hard way not to make a joke about someone who is bald. But now a court in England just ruled against a company that was sued after somebody called a male employee bald. So is bald beautiful? Or is it sexual harassment? That is coming next. You have a couple of minutes to think up your answers. Welcome back, everybody. A court in England has decided that a man named Tony Finn was sexually harassed when he was called a bald C-word by his supervisor. A panel of judges determined that commenting on a man's baldness in the workplace is equivalent to remarking on the size of a woman's breasts. Okay, back now with Ben Ferguson, Francesca Bacardi, and Paula Freilich. All right, Ben, I'm not sure I get the equation that the court determined. Boobs,
yeah.
And I said
Freilich. Yeah, a bald head. This may be the first time in my life I've actually looked forward to maybe going bald, possibly later in life, if this is like the payday at the end of the tunnel of having no hair on my head. It also, I think, proves that we are becoming so stupid as a world and society that we can now believe that equating a man's bald head is the equivalent of talking about a woman's breast. Like, if that's where we are doomed in this world.
It's weird. I agree.
Yeah, Paula, it's not the same thing.
Paula Freilich, there is a thing in this story that made me laugh even harder than the headline itself, and that was the fact that his supervisor called him a bald C word. And the issue with the court was not the C word.
No, it was
they
the baldness.
They didn't have any problem with that at all.
No, it's insane. What was the reason they didn't have an issue? I'm confused. And also, what do you do at work if you've got like three Franks and one is bald? Don't sue me for saying that. And you're talking to people and you're like, you know, Frank with the shiny pate or the follically challenged Frank. I mean,
how are you supposed to? From what I gather, apparently this workplace, he was an electrician for a manufacturing firm. Apparently what this guy, Tim Finn, said was, oh, they use the C word all the time. That's not an issue. Just the bald thing.
It's just the baldness.
But there's no bald people in England where he works? I doubt that. I lived there for 2 years.
It's confounding to me. All right, we've all had problems with our neighbors, you know, loud music, overgrown grass, all the rest. But there's this one lady in Florida who had enough of her neighbor's chickens. They were apparently pooping on her back patio. So what did 57-year-old Christine Terman finally do? Did she knock on the neighbor's door to complain? No. Did she call the cops? Uh-uh. According to the police, she took the time to fill a bucket with human urine and then dump it on her neighbor's head. Francesca Bacardi, I hate to even ask the question, but should that really have been her number one option?
Absolutely not. But also, where did she get this bucket of urine from? Is she peeing in a bucket all day? It raises more questions than it does answers. I really have more questions for what's going on inside of her house.
I don't think you caught my number one reference. That's what's upsetting me most. Like, the number one option. Bada bing. Well, you know what? These jokes don't write themselves.
Yeah.
But here's the thing.
That was my bad. I should have.
I totally get it. Okay, but I will say this. For anybody out there who thinks this might be a good idea, this is actually a battery. It's an assault and battery. So don't think that throwing excrement or urine on somebody is just a light joke or a way to get back on them. You're going to go to jail possibly for that one. Hold your horses, everybody, and show me this. Show of hands, who's a pet owner in this group? Oh, now I can't see the hands, but I'm just going to take a big guess here. I know Paula has a dog named Doug. And I think, Ben, I think you've got a dog. Francesca, yeah. I don't know about you, but there's this brand new poll out there of 2,000 dog and cat owners. They were asked if they would choose their dog over their significant other. How do you suppose fellow Americans of yours weighed in on this one, especially after spending so much quality time together at home over COVID? I have the results right here, and you will see them next. Welcome back. It is a dog-eat-dog world, so this one's going to sting a little bit for some of you. A recent poll of 2,000 dog and cat owners discovered that about one-third, or about 666, said that they would choose their pet over their significant other, which makes me think that the pet is actually the significant other. Ben, I know you've got, is it Memphis?
Memphis, yeah. I've got Memphis named after my hometown. And then when my wife moved to Memphis, right, when we first got married, she got a dog named Houston, her hometown. So we each had one named after a hometown, which is pretty cool. So there's Memphis on the screen. You can see I would pick the wife over the dog. Now, early on, my wife may have picked Houston over me because Houston was pretty incredible. So, yeah, that's Memphis. But he's still going to play second. There's my little guy in, next to him on the box right there, which
so
is pretty
cute.
Cool.
Those pictures and, are great. Yeah. I love that you're just getting on the record, you know, to be clear.
On
now,
the record.
Paula, you've got Doug, right? I love that
I
name for a dog to start with. Is there anybody in your family that you would choose Doug over?
No, of course not. I mean, love me, love my Doug. Doug is the best. He is, he's like a soulmate. I am 667. On that 666 number.
He is so heaven. Doug is everybody to you. He is super
well, I mean,
darn cute.
Also, to be fair, I am not married, nor am I dating right now. So, yeah, Doug's my dude.
That is the number one, like, that's the best Bumble thing you can do is just be on TV and say, and I'm not dating and I'm, you know, not connected right now, so call me. All right, Francesca, you don't have a pet, but do you love the puppy dogs and kitty cats?
I do. I love them. I don't have a pet. I've never had one. But I will say, as an observer of those with pets, I think they get so close to them because it's just a relationship of love. There's no back talk. There's no fighting. It's just constant
I'm
love,
with you
support,
there.
And cuddles. So after the pandemic, when everyone was forced together.
Yep. I have to cut it there. I love you guys. Thank you so much. Have an awesome weekend. I have to turn things over to Marnie Hughes right now. Take care. Bye, everybody.